Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation, heard at americascannabisconversation.com. We're part of the W420 Radio Network, and each week we provide you with information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and recreational cannabis industry. W420RadioNetwork.com. Time now for the lowdown on another high time experience. Here's 420 lifestyle correspondent Rich Walkoff.
Well, it's a happening weekend at the Emerald Cup Harvest Ball, Santa Rosa, California, about an hour north of San Francisco. And today on America's Cannabis Conversation, we're meeting up with Amy Fisher, the founder and curator of the Traveling Hemp Museum. Never heard of it, but it sounds amazing.
Hi, my name's Amy Fisher. I started the Traveling Hemp Museum while I was working with the Jack Herer Initiative collecting signatures so we could show the public what we were trying to re-implement into society.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were you trying to re-implement? And Jack Herer, one of the great cannabis pioneers and advocates.
Man. I loved working with the initiative. I still work with Dan Herer, still, and Jack Kudasal, basically with little Jack. We basically are just trying to keep hemp history alive. Hemp has been used for thousands of years. We wouldn't have even made it to America without hemp sales. Cotton sales would not have made it with the oceans and things like that. What we have in our museum are historical documents implementing the American tax stamp, the laws of hemp cultivation in different countries. We have a plethora of clothing, I mean, things dating from the 1700s to about the early 1940s. We have medicine bottles that are still full, Fizo, Vapopressiline, several of them, in fact, and we'd love to display our medicines. Recently, we just came across a federal government marijuana can that held the 300 cigarettes for the federal patients through their medical marijuana program.
And how long ago does that go back?
Oh, geez, that's 25 years.
Wow, unbelievable. So we think about hemp as the bastard cousin of marijuana, but with so many incredible components, aspects, features, organically, sustainably, you know, good for the environment. Good,
yes.
Yeah, talk to me.
We have plastics, we have fuels, we have biodegradable hemp that just, it reconditions the soil. Every 90 days, you can recondition your soil with your after product. After you're done processing your hemp, you can break it down and re-implement it into your soil and take the toxins out.
You know, obviously, for a long time, it wasn't even legal nationally to grow hemp, but now there's been a change.
Yes, and about the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen an increase in hemp production, CBD buds for patients, and using it to make textiles. We're just now getting to the point where we're able to manufacture hemp in the United States.
Yeah, and I think there was a law passed last year,
yes,
which authorized the legalization of hemp growing,
yes,
in the country.
Yes.
Has that changed the landscape, or is it still stigmatized?
It's changed the landscape quite a bit. We have a lot going on back east with Hemp University and the Bruce Perling Group. They're between Florida and Arizona. They have several universities in between to teach the hemp farmers what they need to do, what type of seeds they need to have to grow, whether they're growing for CBD buds, whether they're growing for textiles. We have different seeds for different things.
Now, economies of scale are key for the economic viability of hemp based products. So how is that unfolding?
Well, it's coming along quite well that they're actually using hemp to make like paper type plates, straws. We have a straw company now where the straws decompose within 30 days. There's so much going on right now as far as the hemp plastics for the 3D printing. So you can print anything you want out of hemp now.
Yeah, I'm thinking of clothes too.
Oh yes,
because
the clothing aspect. I have clothing representing from the 1700s, like I said, until about the 1930s, 1940s. And even the things I have from the 1700s are still as durable today as they were then.
Come on, you talk about vintage. That's beyond vintage. That's
200 to 300-year-old vintage that look brand new.
Yeah, but obviously major corporations,
yes,
that are producing the nylons and the synthetics are unnerved by this and probably lobbying in every which direction to prevent the growth of the hemp industry because it undermines their business.
We have a problem in the United States and all over the world with the excess of clothing. And they don't decompose. They are not returnable unless you're using them to make something else. At least with hemp, we can break it down again and recycle it as many times as we want. In Africa, they're having a problem right now because everybody discards their clothes. That's where it all ends up. And what they're doing is they're turning it into their soil. And they're contaminating their land with all of our garbage.
Yeah, the toxins and the dyes that are used in the manufacturing of cotton-based clothing is now
contaminating their groundwater and their soils.
Right. So could it be more economically feasible to
use hemp as far as making our clothing and our ropes for more sustainability and recyclability? And the toughness of the hemp fabric and the hemp denims is amazing.
Yeah, but again, I come back to cost, because if you want to buy a pair of jeans or a shirt,
it is going to cost you a little bit more to buy something made out of hemp, but in the long run, it lasts you longer, the colors don't fade, and the durability is outstanding.
Right, and it's breathable.
Most of it is being made in the United States now. A lot of the hemp clothing that's for sale, they are outsourcing the fabrics right now from Japan and China, only because we're not up to par making them here in our production yet.
Is that a labor cost issue?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It really is. That, and for everybody to be able to have the machinery, is very expensive to process. That's why I believe they only have one processing plant that I've heard of that they have open, and I don't recall what state it was in. I know it was back east.
When I think of the Build Back Better and Biden's campaign to make America in the 21st century more sustainable, more economically viable.
Like what one thing I forgot to mention was that we have hemp board, okay? If people build their houses out of hemp board instead of destructing our forest, we can recycle that. It is non-toxic. It is does not burn. You can hold a 5-gallon burning propane tank less than 6 inches away from a piece of hemp board, and all you are going to end up with is the black soot from the propane.
Right.
It does not catch fire. We would not have lost half of California in fires in the last several years if our building materials were made out of hemp and not wood.
Yeah, and hempcrete, which is like a concrete style derivative, is also better insulating, keeping you cool in the summer and warmer in the winter.
Yes, it does. It really helps. They have different ways of insulating. We have different, you can make the hempcrete blocks with the lye and the hemp curd, or you can use the hemp board that's already put together.
Yeah, now again, is it financially
okay? Well, you can buy yourself a hemp hardwood floor for $9.99 a square foot. How much is it for a tile?
Probably
7
a lot
to 10? You can actually redo your whole house in hemp wood, the flooring, for $9.99 and $10.99 a square foot, depending on which of their styles you choose.
And it'll probably outlast you and me.
It will outlast us until we'll be dead before it ever gets scratched.
So you're a traveling museum, the Traveling Hemp Museum. We're talking with Amy Fisher, who is the founder and the curator. So you're curating this museum. I love that word because it's so hempish.
Yeah.
So... And you have an American flag there.
Yes, the American flag we have is from World War II, and it was flown in Iwo Jima. It is a hemp silk flag with 48 stars.
Wow, that's pretty sweet. So you travel around
all over the
festivals.
United States. Yes, I go from all of our business summits to things like Emerald Cup and High Times and Hemp Fest and Earth Day we have coming up. I've done Democratic conventions. Anywhere that we want to teach them or that we can go to teach them, I go.
Now, it's cool that cannabis fans would be hemp fans.
Yes.
But Mitch McConnell, who is not a cannabis fan, in Kentucky, the Senate Minority Leader, is the one who voted in favor of the legalization of hemp. So you can cross political lines. It doesn't have to be left versus right.
No, it does not. It does not. There are differences between our THC and our CBD. Our CBD that we need for building materials and fabrics needs to be there. And so does the hemp medicine, because it helps other people who cannot tolerate the THC as far as a medicinal use, either ingesting, smoking, sorry, or between smoking and eating and tinctures and that sort of thing to medicate themselves.
Now, you tell me about the history of hemp medicine that you alluded to.
Okay, most of what I have in my collection are cannabis medicines, and we have full bottles of Fizo, vapopressiline. We have vintage bottles of diarrhea mixture. And excuse me? We need, sorry. what was the question?
We're talking about the medicines.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, the medicines. What we have over there are medicines, and a lot of the bottles over there are full. They are cannabis medicines that date from the late 1800s to about the 1920s.
Now, who created that? And how did people even have any concept of that? Does it go to Native American Indians, perchance?
Yes, I actually have some black Indian hemp over here in the box. They're tablets. They look like white aspirin tablets, but they are black Indian hemp. We also have...
are they designed to do, and how are they created?
Well, they were
created.
Medicine as far as... the tablets and things were created for diarrhea and upset stomach and that sort of thing, for pain.
So kind of a natural approach as the native...
The snake oil pit, oil medicine man, basically.
So what else did they create?
I do have the Eli Lilly pharmacy book that tells you how to make all of the cannabis and heroin and all the cocaine tinctures and that sort of thing in that book.
And this goes back pretty far.
That book is from the 1920s. It is from the Eli Lilly pharmacy.
And then 1937, when cannabis was outlawed, banned, prohibited.
Yes.
Hemp was under that same umbrella.
Yes, but they asked the American farmers to grow hemp for the military for their ropes, for their military needs.
So they had an exemption.
Yes, they did, for several years, up until about the early 1950s, I believe.
So you're a nonprofit,
yes,
educational enterprise.
Yes, I am.
And you've been doing this since 2009?
About 2009 I started, yes.
Okay. And how is the evolution of the reception you're receiving?
I have people who come back to see me every year because they want to see what new artifacts I can find. I try to really base my museum on things that are from the 1700s and 1800s to about 1920.
Yeah.
I have some newer hemp things, like I have a brand new pair of hemp jeans from about 20 years ago over there. But for the most part, I like the true history aspect of it,
yeah,
so that we can show the durability and sustainability of our artifacts.
Yeah, am I correct in saying, wasn't the original Declaration of Independence
written
on a hemp paper?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
You got it? You don't have the original?
I do not have one of those. No, I do not. I do have the implementation of the American tax stamp dictated by King George III in 1727, though.
That's got to be your oldest.
One of the.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1722, cool. I believe, is the oldest document that I have, original document I have.
Well, here we are, almost 2022. Let's get on with it. Let's make this a reality. Let's not make
it
on the fringe.
We're 100 years later, basically, from where they outlawed us. We're 80 years, basically, into this. And we're getting a turnaround.
Yeah, do you sense that the younger generation, Gen X, Gen Z, and the like, are more receptive and more, open and advocates of what you're doing?
We really need to work to get the younger crowd back interested into helping us. They are taking what we did in the last 30 years for granted so badly.
Yeah.
They are not respecting the fact of what we all fought for, what some of us went to jail for, what some of us had to endure to be where we are today. And it's very disheartening and disrespectful.
Yeah.
And we need to find a way to get that age group back in to our fold.
Yeah.
I have hemp Adidas in our museum. They're not here today, but that is usually one of the things on the table that sucks the younger generation into coming to look at our booth. Most of them just walk by, though.
Right. Well, as Bob Marley said, if you don't know the past, you don't know the future.
That's right.
Amy Fisher, you're a doll. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The Hemp Museum, the Traveling Hemp Museum. And we're here at the Emerald Cup Harvest Ball in Santa Rosa, California. Rich Walcuff on the America's Cannabis Conversation. Stick around.
Sun is the source of all our living things, but when winter comes, or the clouds come, or night comes, indoor farms turn to artificial light to make their crops grow. We're talking with Joe Sullivan from Franklin Energy. He's the Indoor Agricultural Program Manager. We're getting a lighting 101 from you, Joe. I'm learning so much. The business energy assessment that you provide to growers, no cost. Tell me more.
It's a great program through Xcel Energy. We have a team here in Colorado that collectively has over 20 years of experience in the cannabis industry, in the controlled environment ag industry. Xcel has hired Franklin Energy to really give growers free advice on how to save energy. So we are free consultants. So we go into grow facilities and take PPFD, light intensity measurements. We measure VPD for growers. We take all environmental measurements, and then we go ahead and provide growers with a report that has recommendations for not only energy savings, but also optimizing growers' environment so they can increase yield and whatnot. So again, that's completely free. Xcel Energy pays the bill for growers' free consultants. And typically it takes a couple hours. We're in and we're out. And then, you know, we give you that really good report that is going to provide recommendations for how you can save money and help out your bottom line. We look at all cultivation equipment within the facility. So like you said, HVAC, dehumidification, airflow and fans. We'll look at your control systems, right? And then we'll make recommendations either how to tweak those systems to perform better now or recommendations to potentially swap out that equipment for more efficient equipment. And on top of that, we will provide energy savings calculations for all those recommendations and estimated rebates for what you might receive by moving forward with those recommendations. On top of that, we're available to really help growers and hold their hand through the entire process of an upgrade.
If I have an indoor grow and I want to make a transition to LEDs and I want to get that Franklin Energy rebate, tell us what we've got to do.
You can contact the Xcel Indoor Ag Program at xcelenergy.com. That's xcelenergy.com. And then from there, you navigate up top to business customers and then select rebates from the dropdown. And finally, you can select business lighting from there. But to get information fast, my email address is jsullivan@franklinenergy.com. Telephone number is 720-822-3719. One of our amazing cultivation energy advisors will help you get started along your journey to be more efficient.
And that's Joe Sullivan from Franklin Energy, the Indoor Agricultural Program Manager. He's a Jedi. Thanks so much, Joe. This is Rich Walkoff on America's Cannabis Conversation.
Welcome back to The Conversation. This is Chase Roberts, Women in Cannabis Correspondent for the W420 Radio Network. Today will be an exciting part one of a two-part series in which we will be discussing the Women and Minorities Cannabis Report, which was released by the Marijuana Business Daily. Today, we'll be speaking with their Editorial Director of New Business Initiatives and Data, Janelle Stelton-Holtmeyer. Janelle, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great. It was a pleasure to meet you at MJ BizCon 2021. It was a great event. You survived all the craziness for days.
I did. It was definitely a great experience, and a lot of people showed up, which was really good. It was great for us as a company to be able to come back and have everyone join us for such a strong event after all the craziness of the pandemic. So I want to thank everybody who was there for joining us and helping us make it so successful.
It was wonderful. So why don't we tell our listeners, how long have you been with Marijuana Business Daily?
I joined Marijuana Business Daily in early 2018, so we're looking at 3.5 years at this point, which in marijuana time is forever.
Yeah, right. And you originally started out as the managing editor as niche content, which was overseeing development for specialized niches in the industry. And it's totally helped guide you in the position you're at now.
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners a little how it all has blended together?
Sure. So when I started in 2018, I was hired on, as you said, as the managing director of niche content. And in that, I was overseeing some of the newer initiatives that the company had taken forward and helping to develop them into kind of their own identities. So for example, hemp was one of the areas I covered, and we helped spin that off into its own sister publication of Marijuana Business Daily at hempindustrydaily.com. And so from there, it just made a natural kind of sense to be focusing on these new areas and new developments, such as our podcast, Seed to CEO, and help develop these things into new areas for getting information out to new audiences that need it in cannabis.
When did you launch your podcast?
We launched it in May of this year. It's a weekly podcast that is an interview, usually with the CEO of our company, Chris Walsh, interviewing someone in the industry, kind of in the vein of, you know, how did you develop your company and what were the challenges and successes that you had for your journey to today? So we've talked to a lot of industry veterans, such as Wanda James, some of the newer folks, and really getting that broad experience of stories for how the cannabis industry has evolved and how individuals within the industry have met those challenges to succeed today.
Storytelling is such an integral part of that.
Yes. And storytelling is my passion.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you have two bachelor's and a master's. You have 2 decades of journalism experience that started in North Dakota. And before MJ Biz, you spent nearly a decade writing and editing a B2B publication. How did your love of journalism begin? Do you know?
I wish I knew where it started. It's really been a part of me. I'm one of those crazy people who, when I was a kid, I knew I wanted to be a writer of some sort. And that just kind of evolved as I got exposed to the different types of writing that were available into journalism. And I just, like I said, love telling people's stories. And as proven by the fact that I keep going back and getting degrees when I get bored, really, I just love to learn too. And journalism provides that opportunity to learn about so many different aspects of the world.
Recently, the 3rd edition of the Women and Minorities in Cannabis Industry Report came out. It's produced and researched by the team at MJ Biz Daily. The 1st edition came out in 2017, and the recent one just came out. Can you tell us anything about the report? How do you produce it? Where is the information coming from?
So the information comes from a wide range of sources. Really, we want to get the information from the people on the ground, the people who are in the operations every single day, as well as the data that is tracked across different state agencies, which is a widely varied collection of data. But really, the core of it is the annual survey that we put out each time that we produce this report that reaches our vast audience of engaged audience, as well as through partners of ours, such as the Minority Cannabis Association, who shared it with their members who may not be directly engaged with Marijuana Business Daily. So really, it's reaching out to that broad an audience in the cannabis to get the information from on the ground, and then connecting that with the data that we have that comes in from states and the federal level.
And what do you think some of the biggest findings were from the latest edition?
Well, the most surprising one for me was how much the percentage of women executives in the cannabis industry declined for the 2021 results. And it fell not only from 2019, which we saw a lot of declines for a variety of reasons from then, but really, it's down below what we saw in 2017 as well. And it's even below the national average for 2020 for all US businesses now. And that was kind of disheartening. It was a number that I had to check and recheck probably 3 or 4 times before I believed it. And every time it came back at this 22.1%, and really diving into what drove that decline was one of the most telling things about this report.
What was the consensus on the decline?
Really what it is so cannabis is such a new industry, and it's one of the first times most people would ever have had the experience to have a legal industry from the ground up and helping to guide that. But what we're seeing now in 2021 is that it's starting to track in many ways, just like any other mainstream industry. And a large driver of that really is where the money is to participate in the industry. It's not cheap to get into cannabis this day, regardless of the state you're looking at. There's a lot that goes into it, a lot of money that has to go into compliance. And the traditional network for getting funding, especially in a federally illegal industry like cannabis that can't access the traditional mainstream funding, is through financial investing networks, which even to this day are still dominated by older white men.
Yeah, there's a lack of access to capital.
Yes. And until we can resolve that issue, I think we'll continue to see a problem.
And I think the listeners should know that the interesting thing about this special report, and where can they find it? Everyone has access to it.
Everyone can download it just in exchange for your email. You can go to mjbizdaily.com and there's a link there to download the report.
Part of the thing I found interesting in reading over the special report was that you did do a whole graph on the different sectors women were in. And I can't go into all the sectors right now, but I will say that the biggest sector at 53.9% was testing labs. And as we were kind of just discussing, that 4.6 as investors, which was the lowest sectors. This indicates so much to me. What does this tell you in this huge discrepancy between these two percentages?
Well, like I said before, and as you referenced, it's the investors is notably lower, just because the traditional networks are still trying to, will still dominate the source of capital. But even the other in categories that are on that low end, such as the vertically integrated businesses or the product manufacturers that are highly dominated by men at this point. What you see at the other end, such as testing labs and consumption lounges, is a lot of the newer segments in cannabis. While testing labs to most people sounds like it's something that should have been there since the beginning, hasn't been. It's really an area where we're just starting to see a lot of pickup on that because we're starting to see more states require more around testing.
Yeah.
In general, but you're seeing that as an opportunity where these new opportunities arise and women are seeing a way to get their foot in the door in the industry that hasn't been completely taken over by men yet.
It's also interesting in the sense that because this industry is so new, every part of the industry is trying to grow together and function properly, which is interesting because now there's also things such as websites just for, you know, cannabis industry employment for either bud tender up to, you know, managers. And this is can be globally. It's really trying to guide itself in places it needs to be to make sure people have access to jobs, everyone has opportunity. Time will see how it changed and shifts, and it isn't as predictable as normal everyday business.
No, it's not. It's one thing that I've heard over and over again in my time working here is the one thing you have to be prepared to deal with when working in cannabis is you have to be prepared for change because it can change on a daily basis. States are always looking to change their regulations, change the taxation, the federal government, we're all watching to see what it does. It's an amorphous industry. It really is. And we're trying to bring it into the mainstream, but fighting against that federal illegality. We're seeing markets like California that have made it such a complex industry to get involved in. I think there are like 26 different license categories in California versus, you know, some of the markets like Oklahoma, where we notably on our podcast had Denise Mink, who's one of the dispensary owners, who said you could stub your toe and get a medical card in Oklahoma. So
yeah, it might be a little easier than some think. It's just, it is really interesting how the federal, just much like our politics, how state by state politics versus, you know, federal will have to find its way to everything flowing and happy. You also have said that social equity initiatives and cannabis legalization are now intertwined. There's no magic bullet, as we've been discussing. How do you personally think some things might be improved just based on the knowledge you have from either all the interviews you've been part of or your findings in general?
Well, the big thing right now is that there's no consistency. When I say that it was intertwined, really, if you look at the OG markets like Colorado and Washington, it wasn't even a discussion back in the day when we were setting up those markets. Now, you can't have the creation of a new state market without the discussion of social equity. It's even a hot topic in the federal legalization. It's, do we include social equity in the Safe Banking Act or do we not? Is that just holding back that advancement? These are all things that I've heard. So it's definitely part of the discussion. And the problem is that there's no magic bullet. Nobody's figured out what the exact tool is that will help improve access, access to capital, access to licenses. And in addition to that, it's not just the application process, it's what comes after. How do you prevent someone who gets a social equity license from selling it to someone who's not a social equity applicant? What are the restrictions that you're comfortable placing on this market in order to foster that social equity development? It's a very challenging thing. And it's just inconsistent across the board yet. And there's a lot of groups that are not having the conversations together that need to be had.
Absolutely. That's why groups like Women Grow and things of that nature are so valuable to help people really trying to get in the industry that maybe aren't in the upper echelon to automatically have access or a way in.
Absolutely. And we're seeing more of them develop over time. And so it's great to see the Women's Business Enterprise National Council, Supernova Women, these incubators that are starting like Treehouse that has been on a break. Really trying to find ways to help women and minorities get involved in the industry.
And just as it's the statistics for female-owned businesses, to be complete and consistent, as we've mentioned, consistency is big. The same with minority ownership in the industry is difficult to come by. But through your research, what are some of the basic factual trends or truths about minorities in the cannabis industry? Have you noticed any? Have you found some?
We've seen a lot of the same trends.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of drop-off. And in a lot of the markets where they say they're focused on development of cannabis business ownership by minorities, it's still falling short of anything that people said that this was going to do. The cannabis industry is really failing at including people who are from communities that have been affected by most by the war on drugs in the industry. You see this, they're getting better. As I said before, when we were talking about Colorado and Washington, we were still excluding people who had felony drug convictions from participation at all. You were seeing that in the hemp side, not just the marijuana side. And so we've started to move away from that. We're starting to see better programs, but there's still this lack of access to capital or lack of knowledge of how to access this legal capital. I spoke with Chris Ball of Ball Farms in California, who was the social equity applicant out of LA. And he was a football player who ended up getting busted for drug trafficking, but ended up turning that into this successful cannabis business. Just talking to him about the experience of trying to get the information he needed to participate in the social equity program was fascinating, because it's not an easy journey for people who may not have experience. And by the way, Chris Ball has a business degree from Berkeley.
And that's crazy. That's actually crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. So you look at this and it's not an easy process, even though they say that they want to make this easier. So now you're seeing markets like Colorado who are looking at trying to right the omission that they had, not talking about social equity back in 2014. And they're creating new license categories that they're trying to dedicate certain amounts or But a lot of those still lack that access to capital and that lack of access to information.
Absolutely. Some of the basic struggles, yeah, they translate across all parts of business, new business, old business. And it's just, I'm really hoping that at some point, everything will catch up as it should, you know. I was looking at some of the numbers for minority employee sectors. And the interesting thing I found here was that 56.5% were in investing for minorities in that sector. And then the lowest sector was 17.3% in hemp. Did you find any rhyme or reason for that? Or
honestly, no. it really is a mystery in some senses that
the investment's there.
The investment people are there, but one of the explainers for this is where you're seeing a lot of the investors come from, the new investors into the industry. What you're seeing is a lot of athletes. More and more athletes are getting involved in investing in cannabis. You're seeing it from Mike Tyson. You're seeing it from several football players who are using it to treat their symptoms of traumatic brain injury, TBI. So you're seeing a lot of people who may fall into that minority category there. What we didn't have a good breakout for here, because we couldn't do this by sector because the data just became too specific, was what those races actually are, because we also had, you know, large participation, not to feed into stereotypes of this at all, but Asian Americans who generally have participated more in the investing segment than Blacks or African Americans. So it is a broader segment there.
Yes. And we will be discussing this more. This is part one of a two-part series. Janelle, I want to thank you for your time today. There's just so much to go over and discuss with this special report that you guys have produced. So I want to thank you for being here today.
Well, once again, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
If you missed any of this great interview with Janelle Stelton-Haltmeyer, you can go to the W420 Radio Network and click on the archive section to listen to this and other great interviews. There will be a part two to this series with Janelle. We will delve more into the special report put out by the Marijuana Business Daily, Women and Minorities in the Cannabis Industry. So be on the lookout for the next episode with Janelle, and we'll be right back.
Well, we all love that big yellow ball in the sky. The sun is the source of all our living things. But when winter comes, or the clouds come, or night comes, indoor farms turn to artificial light to make their crops grow. And what lighting works best? How do we maximize crop growth? Well, let's say hello to an expert, Joe Sullivan from Franklin Energy. He is the Indoor Agricultural Program Manager, talking about the advantages and the rebate opportunity for those who have a system that may be a little outdated or not as technologically advanced. So speak a little bit more about that, if you would.
On behalf of Xcel Energy, Franklin Energy implements their Indoor Ag Business Energy Assessment Program that has access to Xcel Energy's full suite of energy efficient rebates that are available to growers and other commercial customers. So at the moment, Xcel Energy is providing 70 cents per watt installed as a rebate. So for the purchase of horticultural LEDs, Xcel Energy will actually pay their growers to install them. Fantastic. You know, as I said, Franklin Energy does work all over the country for a number of utilities, and there is, at least to my knowledge, no other utility that has as a track rebate for their growers. So right now, if you were to buy, let's just say, a 700-watt LED, you would receive almost $500, so $490 for the purchase of those lights, at least per light, that is. So it's a tremendous financial advantage to buy down the cost of horticultural LEDs, because, you know, we all know that they can be expensive. So it really brings down growers' ROIs to enable them to try out the technology and implement it permanently.
That's awesome. I mean, if you can increase yield, optimize your light spectrum so you save money on the energy, you emit less heat, so that reduces cooling energy costs, you control the UV amount, so reducing the stress in the plants, fewer pests, less fungus and the like. I mean, this is the no-brainer of all time. I mean, I'm learning so much, and I'm sure our listeners are too. So if I have an indoor grow and I want to make a transition to LEDs and I want to get that Franklin Energy rebate, tell us what we've got to do.
Our rebates are actually paid for. They're paid to growers through Xcel Energy. And you can go to xcelenergy.com. That's XCELenergy.com to the lighting efficiency section to take a look at the application there. What we do is really help growers from the start to the end. We'll help you identify where that application's at. We'll help you fill it out, maybe help you select some lights and whatever you want your layout to be. You can contact the Xcel Indoor Ag Program at xcelenergy.com. That's XCELenergy.com. And then from there, you navigate up top to business customers and then select rebates from the dropdown. And finally, you can select business lighting from there. But the better way to get information fast and to participate in any of our programs would be just contact me directly, either by email or phone. My email address is jsullivan@franklinenergy.com. My telephone number is 720-822-3719. One of our amazing cultivation energy advisors will help you get started along your journey to be more efficient.
That's awesome. And we will link that on our site as well, W420 Radio Network. Joe Sullivan, how illuminating this conversation has been. You've shed the light, put a bright light on a dark corner of my mind about indoor grows and LED benefits and the rebates and the like. And that's Joe Sullivan from Franklin Energy, the Indoor Agricultural Program Manager. He's a Jedi. Thanks so much, Joe. This is Rich Walkoff on America's Cannabis Conversation.
Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Today, cannabis and hemp laws are our topic of conversation. What do you need to know to build a thriving company? Few people know more about this than today's special guest, Omar Figueroa. He's the founder of the offices of Omar Figueroa at omarfigueroa.com. Folks, you can check the spelling of that on our website where this interview is posted. This is a firm that has been practicing for more than 20 years. His firm helps clients obtain local permits and state licenses, draft, negotiate, and review contracts and other transactional documents, help with intellectual property protection and strategies, form entities and assist with corporate governance, advise on regulatory compliance, represent clients in front of elected and appointed officials and administrative bodies, and more. That's straight from his website. I've gone through the website, and there is more even beyond this. So how does this relate to cannabis? Omar Figueroa participates on many boards, including the National Cannabis Industry Association and the California Cannabis Tourism Association. Mr. Figueroa also authored a series of books documenting the evolution of cannabis laws in California and now New York as well. You can find these books on Amazon and other places. They are 2021 California Cannabis Laws and Regulations, and New York Cannabis Laws and Regulations 2021. So this is recent stuff, still current, and it has what you're going to find, digested information like you're not going to find anywhere else from somebody who's got more experience than just about anyone. Omar Figueroa, welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
want to talk a little bit about things that have been changing rapidly in the world for cannabis in these last couple of decades. So tell us, what's happening now in the world of laws for cannabis in hemp in California and in other parts of the country?
Well, I think in California, the system which was set in place by Proposition 64 has proven to not have succeeded. You know, it was truly responding to a previous era when we had the threat of federal enforcement, and therefore the state came up with like these Byzantine regulations that were very onerous in an attempt to keep the federal government out of the business that was lawful in the state. And so for that reason, they came up with such a complicated and unworkable regulatory system, you know, that at the regulated level, the taxes are too high, the regulations are too burdensome, and many craft cannabis producers who went into cannabis for the, you know, really to escape the rat race, are now quitting the cannabis industry because the rat race has come to follow them. And, you know, the margins are thin, and the ones who are remaining are these very passionate craft business people who are building small, you know, craft cannabis businesses, and some of them are scaling and able to really get up there, but many of them are hanging on until the federal law gets improved so that we have interstate and international commerce, because many people in California know quite well that California cannabis is legendary, and it's a commodity that, you know, would be wanted all over the world. And I'm talking places like Canada and Mexico and Europe, which are all slowly coming online with full cannabis legalization. This is an exciting time in the history of cannabis, because we're seeing like countries like Germany are going to legalize adult use. States like New York have already legalized adult use, but now they're coming up with the regulations for having cannabis stores. And even before that, we see all sorts of unregulated, you know, free market type enterprises. In New York City, for example, there's all these like unlicensed dispensaries that are popping up. And, you know, it's very interesting to see, you know, in previous decades, if you were to see unlicensed dispensaries popping up in New York City, the response would have been absolutely draconian with the Rockefeller drug laws that are in place. But now that MRTA has really changed the legal landscape, and the cops are not empowered to abuse their authority to that level and putting people away for years for a small quantity of cannabis, there's a lot more activity that's happening now, you know. And it's interesting to see, like, you know, how the different cannabis subcultures in different parts of the country are having their debut.
Yes, debuting in ways that wouldn't have been thought possible not very long ago.
Oklahoma, who would have thought that Oklahoma would have been, you know, right in the middle of the Bible Belt, you would have a state where, you know, medical cannabis is pretty much ubiquitous and the cannabis use is rampant.
Times change, and it's surprising how fast they are changing, and many boats are rising with this tide of change. And you certainly have your finger on the pulse, not only what's happening now, but this is amplified by your history and understanding of how we got to where we are. So you have a projective view on where we're going. And this is something that's got to be important to anybody in the business today, especially in California, as a lot of people have mentioned and mentioned on the show, that the increasing fees on licensing and regulations and everything like that does cut into the margin. So apparently it's very important for anybody in the business today to know how these laws are going to affect them, how they can plan, what their five-year plan is going to be based on that, rather than just go into something and just say, well, let's open up a mom-and-pop store because we want to have a dispensary, and then be surprised that it's really a sophisticated business. It's not like selling baked goods.
Sometimes, like, you know, these entrepreneurs with stars in their eyes, they're thinking it's going to be like opening up the corner store, you know, and it won't be very difficult, but they're not prepared for the level of resources that are required to persuade a local governing body to approve that project, and then once they have that, they have to get their state license and comply with all the state requirements, which can be extremely burdensome for, say, cultivators, because water is a scarce resource in California now, and, you know, they can no longer, like, tap into the hydrological system the way they used to be. Like, you know, pretty much in the olden days, people could just, like, dig wells, no problem, and pull out as much as they're able to. And that no longer is the case. There's all sorts of groundwater regulations in California that have complicated the process for cannabis in particular, because the state, you know, tends to see cannabis as a limitless pot of money. It's like their personal ATM that they can always make withdrawals, until recently when the operators are just screaming foul and they're saying that this is not a workable system. We're getting outcompeted by the unregulated market, and they don't have to deal with, you know, all of these, you know, very onerous regulations. And on top of that, we have to pay all sorts of taxes, and we don't get the tax break of deducting business expenses, which is forbidden by 280E of the Internal Revenue Code. So until there's a change in federal law, you know, so that the tax deductions can be taken on business expenses, it's extremely difficult for anybody, even the best business person on earth, to make a handsome profit. You know, the profits are very thin. You have to play your cards perfectly to make a thin profit. And those who don't, they're going to end up in debt, you know, and they may end up with tax liabilities and all sorts of complications. So it's not like an easy, you know, low-stakes game to play. It's actually quite high-stakes and complicated. In the olden days, all it took was a couple seeds to really start a cannabis business, and that is no longer the case. There's so much permitting, licensing, and, you know, regulations that need to be complied with that it's best to, you know, have a plan for dealing with all that up front. And those who entered, you know, do enter a highly regulated industry. I mean, for me as a lawyer, I enjoyed, you know, the fact that it's still under development, and the my book changes every year and there's new law. So I'm actually working on the 2022 version of both the New York and the California law books, because now rather than three regulatory agencies in California, we have a brand new department, the Department of Cannabis Control. And so they have now promulgated a whole new set of regulations. And so the size of my book is going to change. It's going to be reduced by a little bit as the three sets of regulations get consolidated into one set that basically governs all licensees. But, you know, having to write the book also forces me to pay careful attention to the changes in the law, and that's something that I enjoy, which is, you know, being kind of like an instructor education, and I also teach a lot of continuing legal education seminars to other lawyers, which, you know, keeps me up to speed.
There's certainly a lot involved, as you point out. Rapidly changing laws and regulations, licensing fees, access to resources like water, the fact that you don't have tax write-offs because it's federally prohibited, and no banking. Mm-hmm. You have to look at everything in your county level, your state level, and the federal level as imposing restrictions altogether. So this really takes somebody that takes the intellectual approach as well, not just getting your hands dirty in planting mm-hmm. or building that storefront
right.
because you're a dispensary, or that website because you're going to have at-home delivery or what have you.
Now, the law is changing. So now there's Assembly Bill 45, which allows for hemp businesses for with not that much regulatory complexity. So if somebody wants to really, like, you know, get their hands on the earth and do cultivation of the cannabis plant, you know, they can do that with hemp. And the regulations are much less burdensome. And now with AB 45, you can actually create products that are marketed for consumers made out of this California legal hemp.
Well, you know, the law offices of Omar Figueroa have helped a lot of people navigate the red tape, understand the obstacles, find positive alternatives, and more. What has been the most common complaint your clients have had amid all of these changing values?
Well, I think the biggest complaint has been the complexity of the regulations and the fact that they're constantly changing. We haven't reached the point of regulatory stability, you know, especially now that there's a brand new department in the state of California, the Department of Cannabis Control. I think we will see regulatory stability where they will come up with one set of regulations that basically govern all licensees, and then they can follow that one set instead of having to worry about three different sets that are slightly different. And so I think once there's that regulatory stability, then I think what will emerge will be like the optimal SOPs to deal with that regulatory framework.
This industry has burgeoned to one of the biggest booms we've ever seen in America.
Yeah, many times we do a session that is remote, like via Zoom or via a conference call, and then you know, there's tremendous level of interest in cannabis as well as now in psychedelics, because there's like some municipalities such as Oakland and Santa Cruz and Arcata in California have passed these lowest law enforcement priority for psychedelics local initiatives. And so those local initiatives are deprioritizing for local law enforcement going after psychedelics, and it's potentially going to lead to like a whole new industry.
Here in the United States, the crime rate is directly connected to illicit drugs. When we look at countries that are experimenting with how they handle drug use, substance taking in terms of their criminal code, has their approach had an influence on their crime rate, an influence on the recidivism of crime, and a different perspective from people who are incarcerated? What's happening there with them, Omar?
You ask some very good questions. You know, like, is such an approach going to be more successful when it comes to fundamentally altering the course of these offenders' lives? And I think the answer is yes. You know, by these criminal justice interventions usually change people's lives for the worse, you know, and it, as somebody who's defended like hundreds of criminal defendants, you know, most criminal defendants, unless they're doing it for the publicity and trying to get like a loudspeaker for their actions, they don't relish the purpose of having to defend their case. You know, most people would rather it all be over and they can just go along with their lives. And so I think that decriminalizing like substance use activity makes sense. And I think it was Clarence Darrow who said that attempting to legislate, you know, people's desires and pleasures is bound to fail. You know, like you can't go against, you know, what people want, and people want pleasure. And so I think the better way is to, you know, if people are using excessively, if they're not being responsible, then there's different ways that are more effective than a punitive approach. And I've had many clients who tell me, like, going to jail is like going to, you know, the College of Criminality. Like, what do the inmates talk about while they're sitting in behind bars? They talk about all the crimes they're going to commit when they get out. And they plan their crimes. And, you know, they come up with ideas that they never would have come up with before. I mean, generally, I would tell my client, like, never talk about, you know, your own activity, because assume the other people in jail, you know, are wearing a wire and they're trying to entrap you, and they're willing to lie about whatever you say. So just don't talk about, you know, activity. Talk about, like, sports, music, movies. Jails are really institutions that generally don't rehabilitate people, and people come out worse than when they came in.
We don't need criminal school and people graduating from prison rather than being released from it. But as you say, when decriminalized, it's a different approach. Mm-hmm. My goodness. Well, we'd like to see some of that here, and the precedents being set with what we're learning with marijuana and how things are changing all throughout society because of the legalization that's happened in so many states and a trend that's still continuing. Let us go forward wisely. And to do that, you need to look at the experience from which we came and the intricacies of it, the unseen things about it all, such as what you have studied for more than these past two decades, Omar. Omar Figueroa, helping people understand the ever-changing laws and licensing and the world of marijuana, an expert in the heart of it all, California, and now New York, too, and he has a perspective on it that he shares with all of us. Look for his books on Amazon. Check out his website. And Omar Figueroa, thank you for joining us on America's Cannabis Conversation.
W420RadioNetwork.com.